For nearly 30 years, RoboWorld has been protecting industrial automation in extreme manufacturing environments with our RoboSuit products. In 2016, we diversified into the teach pendant protection space with our Pendant Armor brand of bumpers, screen protectors, and accessories. Think of Pendant Armor as OtterBox protection for robotic teach pendants. We've maintained a focus on protecting industrial and now collaborative robots, and our products offer both protection and insurance for a factory's more expensive capital investments.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Robot Industry Podcast. We're glad you're here, and thank you for subscribing. My name is Jim Beretta, and I'm your host, and I'm super excited to have Chris Tour on the podcast today. Chris is president and CEO of RoboWorld. He's a robotic protection expert. He's a patent holder, a TEDx presenter. He has worked in marketing for GE Aviation, in business operations for GE Energy, and a global product manager for GE Lighting. And I'm excited to have him talk today to our audience about protecting robots. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Jim, it's always good to be with you. I really do value the efforts you make to educate and inform those working in the industrial automation space, whether that be through your podcast, customer attraction events, even the RIA when we work together collaborating on a webinar. I'm looking forward to a fun and relaxed conversation about some of the projects we've worked on, perhaps for some of those listeners attending your podcast today.
Chris, thanks for that. Hey, so my first question to you is why would a robot need protection?
Well, the easiest answer is because you're trying to employ automation outside of the OEM's environmental specifications. That could be temperature, humidity. You may be employing automation in a food or beverage application where you're required to do washdowns using disinfectants or sanitizers, etc. You could be working in an explosive dust or vapor application, class 1 div 1, class 1 div 2, or you may need to protect the product that you're actually producing. Think about the food industry. You don't want things coming off the robot, the end of arm tooling or gripper, and ending up in that food. Or in a similar application, if you're painting, you don't want robots dripping paint on a freshly painted body. There are a lot of different reasons for protecting a robot, and it's not always because you want to protect what's under the suit. It's what's moving across that production line.
Yeah, we kind of sometimes forget that, right? It's like let's protect the robot seals and their and the end of arm tool and such. So that's really interesting. What are we protecting most when we're protecting the robots themselves? Is it the motors? Is it the cables? Is it the joints?
You kind of hit on it earlier. It's actually the seals for the bearings and the lubrication, the oils within the robot. Perhaps you're protecting the overall robot itself, i.e. from high heat, humidity, the explosive environments we just spoke about, reflected RF energy. You're really trying to isolate the robot from this extreme manufacturing environment. And not every environment is that extreme that it would require this sort of protection. But when you do identify it, or the OEM identifies the need for that protection, we're happy to step in and actually customize a solution to your needs. It's not always a full-blown, full-coverage RoboSuit. It could simply be like a torque tube cover where you're drossing or ladling molten aluminum and you just want to protect the upper arm from splash or something along those lines, or from heat. So, it's really application specific, Jim. I'd love to be able to sell, full coverage suits 24/7, but oftentimes that's not the case. It's we really have to look at it on a case by case basis.
So there's a lot of customization in your life.
There is, and I joke with my brother who's in this business with me. We've become material experts, not necessarily robotic specialists, but you have to be able to look at a customer's application, discern whether there are any chemicals or energy or vapors that are going to destroy the robot over time. And then we turn around and we've got to go through 15 to 20 different technical fabrics to match that environment with a suit that's going to stand the test of time. You know, and it's not just the robots, Jim. You know, think too about the teach pendants. For nearly 50 years, these things have been taking a literal beating. They get dropped. They get pulled from their cradles. People walking by get tripped up on the teach pendant cable itself, and it goes flying off a work surface. So pendant armor was designed to actually extend the protection beyond just the robot because, I mean, by my estimates, the teach pendant repair business globally is worth somewhere between $300 and $500 million. And that's independent repair houses, that's the OEMs doing the repairs themselves, or perhaps an integrator or distributor who's developed that expertise in-house and is doing it at the behest of their end users who are now in a bind if they drop that teach pendant.
Yes, and more people, I assume, share teach pendants maybe in a small plant. So the teach pendant becomes very, very important.
It does. I mean, you can swap teach pendants, you know, assuming that the same teach pendant model is operating, you know, similar robots in the plant. But take, for example, Yaskawa Motoman. We have five different generations of teach pendant protection for just that one OEM. And it's an exciting time. You know, ABB is launching a new teach pendant. They have. It's called the Omnicore. Kiba and Denso have released new teach pendants on their product line, as well as KUKA. They just came out with their Smart Pendant 2, or next generation. So, yeah, it's you don't want to be caught in a position where you can't control and you know, tend to that robot without a teach pendant.
Yeah, and I always kind of think of teach pendant like a little bit like your cell phone, right? You're always dropping them, so having a case is absolutely, for me, it's just something that was the second thing I bought when I bought my new phone. I bought my new case and screen protector as well.
Exactly. You know, and back when we were in the early days of launching pendant armor, I went online and I tried to find some sort of entitlement. You know, what should I expect in terms of the number of users of robots to actually protect their teach pendant? And the easiest analogy or the most applicable analogy I could come across was cell phone protection. Hence the moniker, you know, it's the OtterBox for robotic teach pendants. If you believe and you see some correlation between these two devices, you know, a cell phone and a teach pendant, then we should see roughly 75 to 78% adoption for some level of teach pendant protection. And think about it. I mean, phones these days are not inexpensive. You can easily pay over $1,000. But worse yet, if you can't back up or if you haven't backed up your contacts, your data, all your apps, I mean, think about the headache aside from just going to replace the phone, but then having to back up all that data manually. That's a nightmare. And, you know, the same analogy holds true for your teach pendant. How much production is going to be lost in your facility if one robot goes down because you've broken a teach pendant? So it takes somewhere between, say, 2 to 4 weeks to get an expedited repair done. And that's only after one of the repair houses or independent contractors charges you a fee to determine what's wrong and come up with a quote and present you with the cost to repair that pendant. So, you know, they're either going to get you coming or they're going to get you going, but pendant armor is a very inexpensive insurance policy. Every bumper that we offer, whether it be for an ABB or Universal and every other OEM in between, they're $299. I can't think of a single plant where $299 wouldn't cover 1 hour of lost production. It's a concrete way to protect your high capital investments.
No, it's some good points there. So switching back to the kind of robo suits, how do you make a robot suit?
We have tremendous relationships with all the OEMs, so it starts there. We get CAD data. We ask for 3D PDFs so that we can zoom in and look for things that aren't always on the CADs, like hard stops, limit switches, things like that. And then in addition, we also get two-dimensional DXF or DWG files. This allows us to develop a digital pattern, if you will. And at that point, once we have the basis for what the suit is going to look like conceptually, we'll go out and we'll engage a customer, the customer who has come to us and said, hey, we're going to need protection for this particular robot. And it's at that stage we start asking things about the environment, chemicals. Are you exposing the robot to sprue or any kind of sharp metal turnings, swarf, weld slag, and splatter? We really wanted to develop a good appreciation for the environment that the robot's going to be placed in so that we can then, again, turn internally and determine what is the best material to use for that particular project. Oftentimes, we'll develop a prototype. We're in the process of doing that now for FANUC's new R2000 ID arm. And we'll make it from an inexpensive material, but it'll feature all of the same design points and criteria that the production suit would. And the reason we do that is to dynamically test the suit to make sure that we don't restrict the working envelope. And in many cases, it's just to get an overall feel for how well the suit's going to hold up at 100% of the robot's servo speeds. And then once the prototype validation is complete, we move into a full production and validation mode where we'll introduce successive iterations of that suit in different materials, perhaps with a different configuration of rings, for example, which will allow us to flow air through the suit. And you may ask yourself, well, why would you ever need to flow air through a suit? There's a number of reasons for doing so. The first is perhaps you need to heat or cool the robot. Grater's Ice Cream here in Cincinnati, one of the two stalwart ice cream producers, they have a FANUC 710 sitting in a minus 30 degree freezer, minus 30F. And the robot operates like it doesn't even know it's there because the jacket that we have on the robot is being flushed with warm air from one of our heating units. So, you know, tweaking that design is kind of easy, but it's done, again, based on the individual customers that we end up working with. Sometimes it's the OEM, oftentimes it's an integrator, and then, again, it could be the end user themselves who've tried to use an unprotected robot, and they've either wiped a wrist or the tool flange, and now they're coming back to me once they've done the repairs to protect that investment.
You certainly get the dirty, dull, dangerous jobs, and then you get the ice cream jobs, which is kind of fun.
Yeah, that's not without a request for samples on some occasions.
So what materials, Chris, do you find that you're using most?
You know, that's really kind of an application-dependent question, Jim. I think if you were to say, hey, what type of applications are you seeing, you would then learn that the material use is driven by the application. And what I mean by that is, there's a product we use quite extensively called Hypalon. It's a chemically stabilized rubber-based technical fabric that's incredibly abrasion resistant. I mean, we use this in two different weights, either 17 ounce per square yard or 35 ounce per square yard. You can use it in blasting applications, sandblasting, shot blasting, cut wire media. I mean, this stuff is almost bulletproof. And that happens to be one of our more popular materials because the majority of our work is done in blasting, high abrasive environments where even in investment casting, where you dip a part in a slurry and then you coat it with this sand and you repeat the process until you've built up enough of that sand and grit and slurry that you can then mold the production part. Well, think about how tough that is on an unprotected robot. You'll take the paint off right down to the bare metal in a matter of months if you don't protect it. So Hypalon happens to be one of our more popular fabrics because we do a lot of work in the blasting environment. And then I would have to say the next most popular is going to be a product called Norfab, and that's an aluminized Kevlar. The Kevlar is a substrate material. And we routinely use that in applications up to 1,250 degrees Fahrenheit. It's the same material you will see workers on a foundry deck or in a steel mill walking around in. It's those silver suits with the big kind of golden tinted face masks. It's a very good material for tackling both high and low temperatures. So, and then probably our third most popular is Teflon. Teflon is used in both the food and beverage vertical because it's chemically inert. It won't harbor bacterial growth, and it stands up to every known sanitizer, disinfectant, caustic washdown material that we know of. Teflon can also be used where you have like industrial chemicals. Think about amines, which are corrosion inhibitors, in a CNC tending application, for example. The nice thing about Teflon is that it's impervious to all known chemicals. The trade-off is it has no internal fabric support or what we in the sewing industry call a scrim. So what happens here is if you're tending a machine that has sharp metal turnings and those turnings start to accumulate on the robot and all of a sudden one of those turnings pierces the suit, there's a good likelihood that that could propagate. So you have to be judicious about where you spec Teflon, and then you need to communicate with the end user the importance of good maintenance, cleanliness, keeping the robot suit as free from debris as possible, because we want this suit to last as long as it can for anyone that we sell it to. But, you know, those are some of the materials that we use. But like I said earlier, we've got maybe 19 additional fabrics. We recently started working with a company out in New Jersey called Millimeter Wave Technologies. And this is a really cool company because what they can do is they can sew or manufacture a cloth or a fabric specifically tuned to attenuate a specific radio frequency, whether that be X-ray, RF, infrared. I don't know if we've approached Mike yet to talk about infrared suppression, but he can tune those fabrics to meet the end user's exact attenuation needs. And that's really cool. I wish I could show you what it looks like underneath the layers, but it's Star Wars technology, Jim. It's really cool.
No, that's very exciting. It's really, really fascinating. And I'd love to find out more about, you know, why you would need this too, maybe in a separate conversation. I wanted to ask you though, so you typically will deal in very harsh environments. What are the worst environments for you?
The worst are typically the one-offs. And what I mean by that is you'll get a government agency that has decided to work with an integrator. And let's just say, for example, they want to put a robot in a vacuum chamber. Okay, there's hurdle number one. Hurdle number two, the material cannot be reflective in the visible, infrared, and other specific frequencies. Okay, hurdle number two. Hurdle number three, when you operate in a vacuum down to, say, -7 torr, your basket of available materials quickly shrinks to the size of a thimble, because at -7 torr, materials begin what are called outgassing. So the constituents that may have gone into the production of that technical fabric start coming out of the material itself. It's no longer this homogeneous sort of single piece of material. As the vacuum increases, stuff starts coming out, vaporizing, and it ends up in the vacuum chamber. Well, people don't just put robots in a vacuum chamber to put a robot in a vacuum chamber. They're running tests. They're trying to do specific things and see how things react. So there's very expensive equipment that will analyze what the robot is manipulating. And if you outgas these products, it gets on the lenses and it starts to contaminate those very precise instruments, and you can't have that. So that's just one example. You know, and to be frank with you, we always swing for the fences. And in this particular case, we swung, but we missed. And what we learned in the process is incredible, because we can now leverage that to other applications. We now know what to ask. Oftentimes, you go in just as blind as, you know, your integrator or the end user, because nobody's done this before. So it becomes an iterative process. And in this case, we couldn't identify the material that would stand up to those environmental extremes. When you get down to minus 7 torr, the temperature in that cell just plummets. I mean, we're talking negative hundreds of degrees. And even if we could find a material that wouldn't outgas, that was non-specular, at minus 100 or 200 degrees Fahrenheit, you encounter what is called cold crack or embrittlement, where the fabric doesn't behave like this nice, supple fabric you and I normally think of, like a cotton shirt. It behaves like a 2x4. So you lose the ability to allow the robot to do what it was originally intended to. And that was one of our more difficult, albeit unsuccessful, but we run into what I call science projects at least once a month. I mean, this could be a company trying to employ a robot in a mining operation where it's underwater. This could be somebody who's got a 20-foot wide by 100-foot long billet of rolled steel that's 1,800 degrees, and they want to move a robot arm 6 inches away from the surface and peen numbers and production data onto that slab at 1,800 degrees. So, you know, it never ceases to amaze me what people are trying to do with robots. I should probably start a list, and you and I could talk about it over a drink sometime, because it's truly amazing.
I'd look forward to that. So in kind of just digging a little deeper, what are the most popular robots? You must see some kind of trends.
Oh, my goodness. You know, the collaborative storm that Universal unleashed shows no signs of slowing down. And those are great arms. You know, the collaborative robot has really opened automation to many small and medium-sized enterprises who would never have spent or considered spending the capital requirements to install fencing, conveyors, the whole shooting match that you typically see with heavy industrial automation. But the bulk of our sales, ironically, are still, I would say, 70% skewed toward the heavier industrials. And it follows market share largely. You know, it's the Fanix, it's the Motomans, ABB, KUKA, etc. Those are still the go-to OEMs for heavy industrial. But if I come back to the collaborative space for just a moment, you know, I saw, it may have been on the IFR's website or maybe RIA's, now A3, there was a report that had some 120 different collaborative offerings. And think about that. That's just in the space of, well, when did Universal come out with it? Was it 15, Jim? 2015 timeframe?
You know what? I think you're about right, but they really capitalized on it. But it's around 10 years now.
Mm-hmm. So 120 new entrants in 10 years' time. That's a new collaborative manufacturer coming on board every month for the past 10 years. So, you know, we've sort of made our bets on a handful of collaborative manufacturers. And because we're based in the U.S., we try to follow market trends here as closely as possible. So some of the more popular, collaboratives include, obviously, Universal. There's Techman Robotics. Omron has come out with a couple of their arms. Albo, they made a nice splash maybe 2-3 years ago, but the pace of that activity working with Albo has kind of tapered off a bit. But, of course, we're working with Fanuc. We're working with ABB, with Motoman, all of their collaborative products as well. And that includes the novel teach pendants that go with those collaborative applications.
Are there any kind of areas that you see as kind of big repeat buyers of RoboSuits?
Yes. I mean, if you think about large jigs or seventh axis positioners doing heavy deposition welding work, whether that be a truck, off-road, construction, farm equipment, whatever – you get a tremendous amount of slag accumulation. And we'll protect something, for example, similar to a Fanuc F200 positioner with a very heavy siliconized fiberglass material. And this stuff stands up really well to slag, temperature extremes. But because it's fiberglass based, it has somewhat of a limited lifespan, because if you flex, think about a piece of fiberglass that you might, you know, find in a commercial application. If you flex it time and time again, those glass fibers ultimately start to wear out. So, you know, many of these heavy deposition welders will come to us for those positioner covers, and it's almost like a 3-month replacement window, because it just it takes such a beating and it accumulates so much solid metal that it no longer becomes effective to try and knock it off and reuse the product. The same is true of foundry deck applications. I kind of spoke to it earlier, but you know, when you've got hot, gritty, you've got heat, lube accumulation, it becomes very taxing on the robot. There's a photo I think I've shared with you back when we were doing an RIA webinar, but it's a picture of a six-axis robot. You would never know the manufacturer because it was just caked in dried on, baked on graphite lube. You know, so what the robot does in this application is it reaches into a forging press, for example, holding what is called a tree. And that tree is nothing more than an arrangement of spray nozzles. It goes in, it sprays the upper part of the forge press, and it sprays the lower part. As it's backing out, it's creating a draft. So all of that sprayed graphite dye lube is now wafting backwards, cooling, and settling on the robot. And over time, I kid you not, it can accumulate up to 1 to 2 inches on the robot. Now, imagine trying to do routine maintenance on that, let alone how it's impacting the payload capabilities of that arm when you've got, you know, an inch or two of baked on lubricant, spray lubricant. Those are big repeat buyers for the very same reason. It's very hard to maintain these robots without protection. So many of those people realize that and they come back to us time after time because there really isn't a good alternative.
And it reduces the maintenance overall. But like you say, when you're chipping an inch of slag, well, an inch of dried lubricant off a robo suit, it's pretty intense.
Yeah, you know, you won't do that on a suit. You'll simply take it off, pull a shelf spare, put it on the robot in under a shift, and you're, you know, basically starting with a brand new suit, and you could go another 6 months, you could go another 9 months, but imagine trying to chisel that off the robot, an unprotected robot. I mean, you've got process lines, pneumatic lines, it's just a nightmare. And, oh, by the way, those Zerk fittings where you intended to, you know, replace the lubricants or the grease, forget it. Might as well go in with a hacksaw.
Yeah, put a new one on.
Yeah.
So, you know, kind of up, so you've been doing this for like 30 years. So what trends are you seeing overall in the industry? Are you seeing like bigger robots, smaller robots, more cold, more hot environments?
Yeah, you know, the march of the collaborative robot is getting louder and louder, and it's for all the right reasons. They're inexpensive, they're easy to program, they're redeployable. They don't come with a lot of the baggage that the larger, more capital-intensive robots bring with them. So they offer a tremendous amount of flexibility and leverage for people who otherwise wouldn't be excited to explore automation. So collaborative arms, as I said earlier, they're gaining a tremendous amount of popularity. And it's a bit of a two-edged sword for us. We want to be there because we believe in that market. We believe in the future of collaborative arms. But they're typically smaller. They're less expensive. So from a selfish perspective, they're dilutive to what I would do otherwise with a larger, say, Fanuc M2000, right? Or a Motoman GP800, where the cost of that suit could be 4 to 5 times as much as a UR5. So, you know, we're seeing a tremendous uptick in collaborative, and it's for all the right reasons, and we're here to stay. We want to be the protection provider of choice. What else is kind of trending nowadays? Oh, so I spoke earlier about the RF, the radio frequency attenuation. We started working with a large OEM. They happen to be a European OEM, but they're doing testing on a lot of their electrical components using robots. And when they test them, they're exposing these things to different radio frequencies. And I don't, to be honest with you, that's over my head. I don't know why or for what purpose, but they have to shield the robot from many of those emissions. So that's when I said earlier, we partnered with Mike Katz and Millimeter Wave Technologies out of New Jersey. And he's really got some neat capabilities there. Like I said, he'll tune that fabric to whatever frequencies this the automotive OEM needed. What else? Food and beverage. It's you know, coming out of this pandemic, I think we saw, and I'm not telling you anything new, but the rates of transmission among food processing plants, whether that be chicken, beef, pork, or whatever, the COVID transmission rate was, it just skyrocketed in those facilities. So we're seeing a lot of interest now that we're coming out of the pandemic to replace many of those workers who, you know, stood within 3 feet of one another on a line processing pork, beef, chicken, whatever. A lot of producers are looking to automate some of those processes, and it's posing some challenges, not the least of which is FDA or USDA certification. You can't just walk into a facility like that and use a product that you would normally use, say, in a machine tending application. It would never pass muster, nor would it hold up to the sanitizers, disinfectants, gamma radiation, sterilization, that's unique to those food processing facilities. So that's another trend. We're trying to stay ahead of it. We're looking at new materials, new manufacturing techniques, so that we are, again, a long-term player in the food and bev vertical.
Thank you for this, Chris. Anything else new or any other innovations or products that you're working on that you'd like to chat about?
In the next 2 days, we're going to be releasing all of those new Pendant Armor products that I spoke to you about earlier in the podcast. The ABB Omnicore, Denso RC9M, Kiba Keytop T150, and the new Cuco Smart Pad 2. Those will all be available on the website, hopefully July 1st, without any glitches. It's moving its way through the development server right now, and I like the way it looks. I like the feel. So if anybody's in the market for teach pendant protection, please visit us, take a look at those new products as well. One other technology that's starting to play a more prominent role in protecting robots is actually 3D printing. The way that we connect suit components to one another can either be a simple cuff, like a material overlapping cuff. It can be a bellow, kind of like an accordion, which allows movement in basically two directions. The bellows compress and then they extend. But then there's a third form, which is called an interlocking ring. Think about how the fourth axis behaves on a robot arm, or think about how the upper arm rotates around the lower arm at J3. So those, we can sew them, and that currently is the most cost-effective, proven way to accommodate rotational movement on a protective cover. But 3D printing is opening up some other opportunities. We have some hurdles to get over, but we're probably going to see more and more 3D printing applications on the suit side. Yaskawa has come to us based on our relationship. We private label Pendant Armor products for them. They're moving and looking at 3D printing technology from us that will allow them to protect their DT, direct teach puck. This is an accessory that will bolt onto the tool flange of an HC10 or HC20, and it has user-friendly interfaces or buttons on the puck itself. Some of the first applications that they're looking to use this 3D printed technology is in welding applications. And if you or your listeners know, the closer you get to a welding arc, you're exposing these materials to unbelievably high levels of UV radiation. So we've actually found a product that stands up well to the intense UV radiation, and we're in our final kind of negotiations to get that product into Yaskawa's hands.
Well, those are some kind of neat innovations, so I'm glad I asked the question, Chris.
Absolutely.
How can people get a hold of you if they have some more questions or they'd want to find out more about what you're doing?
Well, the easiest way is probably going to be to go to roboworld.com, contact us. You can find my direct email there, which is chris@roboworld.com. Alternatively, I enjoy a tremendous network and connectivity on LinkedIn. If you look for Chris, parentheses, Christian, Tour, you'll find me there. I'd be happy to connect. Otherwise, you know, there's a contact form on the website as well.
And RoboWorld is R-O-B-O World, so there's no T in Robot World.
Correct. RoboWorld.
And Chris Tour is spelled T-U-R, last name.
Correct.
Thanks again for joining me, Chris. I really appreciated the conversation.
My pleasure, Jim. Always great to connect with you.
Our sponsor for this episode is Ehrhardt Automation Systems. Ehrhardt builds and commissions turnkey solutions for their worldwide clients. With over 80 years of precision manufacturing, they understand the complex world of robotics, automated manufacturing, and project management, delivering world-class custom automation on time and on budget. Contact one of their sales engineers to see what Ehrhardt can build for you. I'd like to thank and acknowledge our partner A3, the Association for Advancing Automation. They're the leading trade association for robotics, vision and imaging, motion control and motors, and the artificial intelligence technologies. Visit automate.org to learn more. And I'd like to thank our partner Painted Robot. Painted Robot builds and integrates digital solutions. They're a web development firm that offers SEO and digital social marketing, and they can set up and connect CRM and other ERP tools to unify marketing, sales, and operations. And if you'd like to get in touch with us at the Robot Industry Podcast, you can find me, Jim Beretta, on LinkedIn. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening. Be safe out there. Today's podcast was produced by Customer Traction Industrial Marketing, and I'd like to thank my nephew, Chris Gray, for the music, Chris Colvin for audio production, my partner Janet, and our partners A3, Painted Robot, and our sponsor, Ehrhardt Automation Systems.